You are listening to Locally Sourced Science, your connection to the scientific discoveries happening in the Finger Lakes community.
Hi, and welcome to the April 15th, 2018 edition of Locally Sourced Science. I'm Gina Mason. We've had some crazy weather over the past couple of weeks, and many of you, like me, may be wondering when it will start feeling more consistently like springtime. Today on our show, Patricia Waldron chats with local apple farmer Chip Bailey, as well as Cornell professor Toby Alt, about spring here in the Finger Lakes, and how we can better predict the onset of spring using new forecasting tools. For our In the Field segment, Liz Mahood talks with Jenna Hirschberger, a graduate student in plant breeding and genetics, who's developing a smartphone app to help cassava plant breeders identify different characteristics of their crops. Now, over to Esther Rakusin for this week's Science News.
I'm Esther Rakusin, presenting the Science News for the week of April 15th, 2018. Have you ever chopped up beets and noticed that the bright red juice released from the cut surfaces of the root vegetable stain your cutting board? You have observed that the natural staining abilities of the vegetable just can't be beat. A group of scientists from the Cornell Department of Food Science have figured out a way to process natural beet juice so that it can maintain its bright red color and be used in place of synthetic dyes in a variety of foods. The work was recently published in the journal Food Hydrocolloids. Dr. Alireza Abbasporad and colleagues treated the beet extract with locust bean gum, sodium alginate, or gum arabic under extremely high pressure in a hyperbaric chamber. They found that this treatment improved the stability of the red beet dye during food processing at high temperatures and at low pH. The technique could allow food scientists to add color to foods without having to use synthetic red dyes that are potentially harmful to health. Scientists at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the University of Oxford are taking advantage of weather radar that can predict April showers by using the same radar to detect movement of masses of migrating birds. Viewers of the lab's BirdCast website can watch animated visualizations that track migration in real time. Cornell Lab postdoctoral associate Adrian Doctor designed an algorithm that picks up the intensity and flight direction of migrating birds. The Lab of O scientists can use the algorithm to predict the movement of birds up to 3 days ahead of time. Benjamin Van Doren, a Cornell graduate and PhD candidate at Oxford, says, quote, "Knowing when and where a large pulse of migrants will pass through is useful for conservation purposes. The BirdCast project is a collaboration among the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Oregon State University, and was funded by grants from the National Science Foundation and Leon Levy Foundation." Can a homeowner be trained to change their energy-wasting ways? According to a study by Ithaca College Assistant Professor of Psychology Catherine Caldwell, the answer is that, once educated about conservation techniques, a homeowner can indeed learn how to change their ways. Caldwell and colleagues worked with Snug Planet, a local home energy contractor. She crafted an experiment where homeowners requesting a home energy audit were randomly assigned to receive either a standard audit or an additional energy education visit. During the visit, they would be educated about low and no-cost options for reducing energy use in four areas: lighting, appliances, electronics, and hot water. The study results showed that the homeowners who received the extra instructions about reducing energy use were more likely to adopt energy-saving practices than those who only received the energy audit. Over a three-year time period, about 170 households participated in the study, which was funded by the New York Energy Research and Development Authority. And that's all for this week's Science News.
year, springtime in the Finger Lakes area is late. After weeks of unusually cold and dreary days, most people I know are chomping at the bit to get some sunshine and warm weather. Now, obviously we can't control the start of spring, but what if we could predict when it happens? That's exactly what one Cornell professor is trying to do. Later in this episode, I'll talk with Dr. Toby Ault, assistant professor in the Earth and Atmospheric Sciences Department. He has created a spring casting tool that he hopes will provide accurate predictions for the onset of spring to help farmers plan for the spring season. But first, I spoke with Chip Bailey, an apple grower in Western New York. We talked about the uncertainty of spring weather, the risks that early springs and late frosts pose to his apple crop, and why he may be the only person in New York State who is enjoying this cold late spring.
My name is Chip Bailey, and my wife and I are first-generation farmers. And together we own and operate K.C. Bailey Orchards Incorporated in Williamson, New York. So initially, we grew apples, cherries, and grapes. And currently, so our top three varieties that we grow for the fresh market are Sweet Tango, Honeycrisp, and Gala.
So I assume you've been doing this for quite a while then?
I graduated from Cornell in 1987. So this is my 31st year.
Wow. Have you noticed any changes in when spring happens in that time period?
Well, every year is different. Every year is unique to its own. And people close to the land understand that. To be honest with you, the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years, we've seen an uptick in the unusualness of the weather and the climate.
What kind of problems do you face on an orchard when you have an especially early or late spring?
Well, the early spring is the bigger challenge. So we're more prone to freeze damage, which, you know, can definitely affect our income. When you're in the fresh market business, it's not just the loss of the apple, but the loss of the quality of the apple. So cosmetic things like russet, which can be caused by frost, would affect our bottom line. Everybody thinks, as an apple grower, you're way more busy in the fall during harvest than you are in the spring. But for me, it's the inverse of that, because with the apple harvest, we're harvesting apples every day. It's the same job. The springtime work, so many things have to be done at the same time. And then when you have an early spring, it like puts your work schedule in a crucible. Probably the third factor is it's just a lot more expensive of the growing season. So the apples are, you know, leafed out earlier, so they need to be protected from insects and diseases longer. Trees are growing over a longer period, so they need to be irrigated over a longer time frame. We need workers for a longer time frame as well to accomplish these tasks. So it is a lot more expensive of a growing season with an early year. With a late year, you're somewhat worried about getting harvest in before you have a killing frost. You know, the later season, apple season, can be a challenge too, but the earlier season is the bigger challenge for us.
Have you had a year recently where you lost a big portion of your crop?
2012 was a challenging year for us. We lost, I think, 40% of our crop that year. What we had left was damaged with russet because of the early spring.
How is this spring going for you so far?
This spring so far has been great. It's been cool and cold, and around here, the only ones smiling are the apple farmers. because the weather is cold and cool, and my wife would love to see spring right now, but I got to be honest, I'm happy we're not, we don't have to protect the trees right now.
If there was a way to reliably predict when spring would happen, would that be useful to you?
Just as an overall planning thing, I mean, farming is becoming extremely data-driven, too, like a lot of other industries. Definitely, you know, utilizing models and tools to help forecast things, not just spraying, but weather patterns as far as, like, irrigation needs and stuff like that are helpful.
Dr. Toby Ault is hoping to make spring forecasting a reality. Using a whole lot of data and an army of lilac bushes, he has attempted to predict the onset of spring as it spreads across the country. If his model works, then it could tell farmers when to expect spring weather months ahead of time. Here's his best estimate for when spring will finally begin in the Finger Lakes.
On April 20th, we are looking at a slightly later than average spring onset. And the way that we define spring onset is using a model of the first date on which the lilac leaves emerge. And the reason we focus on lilacs is because they've been monitored and modeled for decades. It actually started back in the 50s with a scientist in Montana State who was interested in phenology, so the cycle of animals and plants with the progression of the seasons. And he recruited a network of over 1,000 volunteers to have lilacs in their yard that they were monitoring. And every spring, just record the date on which their leaves first emerged and when their blooms first blossomed. And that data set was built up over decades. And at the same time, their efforts to record meteorological information alongside those lilac observations. And eventually that grew into what is now the National Phenology Network in Tucson, Arizona. But in the interim period, the data, both the meteorological data and the lilac observations, were used by a professor named Mark Schwartz to develop a quantitative model, a statistical model of the relationship between weather and lilac leaf out. This is like really early great citizen science work. And because of that, the model of lilac leaf out and the model of lilac bloom dates is pretty accurate if you know the weather. What we've added to that is a prediction using state-of-the-art weather forecasts and seasonal forecasts of the timing of spring, not just, you know, the day of or a few days before, but weeks or maybe even, you know, a month or two ahead. And so when I say that April 20th is our predicted date, what I'm referring to is this idea that we have an index for the timing of spring, and that index is telling us it's going to be a little later than average. And around here, the average date is usually around April 15th. So about 5 days later than average is what we're predicting.
Do you have lilacs in your yard?
I do. I have several lilac bushes in my yard, and I've been taking pictures of them every day, and they're cooperating so far. They haven't opened up yet. You know, as long as they open up on April 20th, I'll be happy. And then last year, they cooperated very nicely. It was, I think we predicted April 18th, and they came out exactly at the end of the day on April 18th.
So you started predicting the spring onset back in January, is that right?
This year, we started in January. We got everything set up, and we did our first official release of our spring casting seasonal outlook on Groundhog's Day, because we wanted to see if we could do better than a rodent.
How have those early estimates panned out?
So far, they've been pretty good for the southeast and the southwest and a lot of the central part of the U.S. And now we're watching the last few weeks unfold and kind of holding our breaths, because this is the first time we've done it live. And so I guess we'll have our answer pretty soon. By the end of this month, it's looking like most of the Northeast and a lot of the rest of the coterminous U.S. should be seeing spring onset.
Exciting.
Yeah, we're ready for it.
Have you been working with farmers to get this information out there?
We have been working with the Cornell Institute for Climate Change Solutions, and it's led by Allison Chatterton. She and a network of Cornell Extension agents have been working with farmers to get their feedback and also to try to disseminate the kinds of data products that we're developing. We have presented this in a few workshops for farmers fairly recently and tried to get a better understanding for what resources they would need for making decisions on, you know, seasonal or long lead time horizons. And the number one thing that, you know, that keeps coming up is this issue of the start of the growing season and the potential predictability of drought or of early spring or fall spring. And so we're trying to be responsive to that that demand for information from the farmers and growers in the region.
With climate change, is it harder to predict the weather?
I think that's a great question. Is it harder to predict the weather because of climate change? And it has two answers. So I think the first answer is yes. In some sense, it's harder to predict the weather because of climate change, because we are increasingly seeing new patterns or new combinations of patterns that just haven't really been observed before. On the other hand, there's some built-in predictability from climate change, because we know on average, most years in a decade are going to be warmer than they were in the past. So we get part of the predictability built in from climate change by just expecting things to be warmer and warmer earlier on average. But the details of that warming and what that warming means for weather patterns is potentially harder to predict now than it was in the past.
Do you have plans to continue working on this model?
Yeah, this is really just a prototype at this point. We would like to refine it and include a larger number of spring onset indicators than just the one or two that we have in there now. We also have plans to include a moisture component so that we're not just targeting the temperature window of spring onset, but also that moisture window that's critical for farmers to get out in the field. And in addition to that, we'd like to be able to do a better job of making long-range predictions about drought impacts during the summer. And I think along those same lines, there are many other models of fruit trees and of crop development that require meteorological data as inputs. And we're interested in working with those communities to supply the long-term weather forecasts so that predictions of other species and other crops or other trees can be made on long lead time horizons. And one of the advantages, if you can make a prediction on a long lead time horizon for a particular crop or a particular fruit tree, might be that if you expect it to be an early spring and a high probability of a fall spring, that could help help with strategic planning purposes for allocating resources to cope with that hazard as it unfolds.
Do you keep a summer vegetable garden?
I don't. My wife, however, is much more of the gardener than I am.
Can you use these to predict when you should put your seedlings in the ground?
That's something that I haven't done yet, but we could in principle do. I think for anyone growing tomatoes in their house, it would be nice to know when it would be safe to put them outside. And so at some future date, in some future iteration of this spring casting effort, we'd like to have like a tomato index for when it would be safe and when it would be reasonable to put the tomatoes out.
Bet that would be very popular.
We hope so.
I followed up with Dr. Alt recently, and it looks like spring may hit a little later than predicted, probably closer to the end of the month. He will continue to update his predictions throughout April so that he can improve his model for next year. To see if we're still on track in the Finger Lakes, or to find out when spring will hit in your neck of the woods, check out the Cornell Climate Smart Farming website. We've posted a link to the spring casting tool on our website and Facebook page. Happy spring, everybody!
I'm Liz Mahood with Locally Sourced Sciences in the Field segment. For this segment, I went into the field of Cornell's graduate students to see what research was being done to address an aspect of climate change. I found graduate student Jenna Hirschberger, who is working on an app that will ultimately make the process of breeding cassava, a staple crop in Africa, much easier. This is related to climate change through the knowledge that changing climate conditions put many staple crops around the world in jeopardy. In the interview, Jenna will use some technical language to describe her app. Two terms he uses are model and spectra. By model, Jenna is referring to the computational mechanism that enables her app to give a correct output with a specific input. And with spectra, Jenna is referring to wavelengths in the electromagnetic spectrum, which her app uses to assess dry matter content in cassava. Here is Jenna to tell us more.
I'm here today with Jenna Hirschberger in the lab of Dr. Michael Gore in Cornell's plant breeding department. Mm-hmm. And Jenna is going to talk with us about her app, which is potentially going to be called Prospector. So Jenna, if you could please sum up what your app does in the suite of apps and tell us what you think is really special about your app.
Sure. So my app, which we're right now calling Prospector, but that's subject to change, takes a little spectrometer, a handheld spectrometer, that measures near-infrared wavelengths, and it connects via Bluetooth to your smartphone, and then the app will process the spectra that are measured and output a prediction for whatever property we build the model for. So we're starting with dry matter content in cassava. So that is kind of like the ratio between solids and water in the root.
So what is the end goal? Like what are people going to be able to do with this app?
So right now, cassava breeders, when they're looking at their plots, have to measure the dry matter content of each plot in one of two ways, but both of them are pretty labor intensive and require taking all the roots to a lab, chopping them up, drying them in an oven. It takes over a day to do this whole thing. Our hope is that they'll be able to slice the roots in the field, and then we can scan the roots and get a prediction on the spot of the dry matter. And so that they could measure like one root at a time just to check things. They could measure multiple roots per plant, average them.
Yeah.
Either way, it'll just make the whole process a lot more efficient.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like it. So my next question is, where did the idea for this app come from? Was it something that you thought of yourself, or somebody else said, hey, this is something that would be really helpful for me, let's get somebody to work on it?
So it's kind of a combination of the two, I guess. So one of my colleagues or classmates in the department was working on a handheld spectrometer that does the same thing, but his instrument is a lot more expensive and bulky. And I was just reading about spectroscopy and everything, and I saw the citation for this device and saw that it was on Kickstarter. So I decided to check it out and found that it had been fully funded and was starting production. So we ordered one and then started to try it out, and the whole idea kind of came together through that.
That's really cool. That, what's the word? Serendipity?
Yeah, I guess.
That's really neat. So what are future plans for this app? So let's say you finish development and then it's a fully formed product.
Mm-hmm. So the final product will be this model that I'm working on right now will be in the app, and breeders will be able to use it in the field. So they'll have teams of technicians doing the harvest who will slice the roots, scan them, and get a number back right away that'll be recorded with the plot information, and then that can go straight into their analysis. The dream is that all of this, like all of the app, everything will be free. So once the organization invests in spectrometers, then they'll be able to use the app freely in their phenotyping process. And a word that's come up again and again when talking to cassava breeders and technicians is the word drudgery, like hard labor, like unnecessarily hard. There's a lot of digging, there's a lot of like lugging heavy things around. And so this would totally reduce that amount of work for people. So
So your project, it deals a lot with both computer science, phenotyping, and this concept of plant breeding and food security.
Mm-hmm.
Given that you come from that background, what is your take on the ability of computer science to solve major issues in plant breeding and food security?
So I think specifically on the phenotyping side of plant breeding, so there are a lot of things that just take a lot of time to collect the data for, mm-hmm. and I think that there are a lot of opportunities for applications of computer science to reduce the amount of time and effort that it mm-hmm. takes to take these phenotypic notes on the plants. So, like, in our case, like, a day less of physical labor, or some of the other apps in the suite allow you to count things instantly instead of doing it one by one. It can increase the accuracy with which you're able to take the notes, decrease the amount of time, and you can also take notes on things that aren't possible just by eye, such as, like, quantifications of shape or different things like that,
sure.
which might be able to help breeders then make better decisions about which plants they're selecting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so last question. Is there anything else that you'd like us to know about your app or the suite of apps that you're working on?
I mean, the apps are available for free on the Google Play Store, so anyone with an
wow.
Android phone can download any of the apps. They're
That's
under
pretty cool.
Pheno apps, but
Neat.
It's, I mean, yeah, they're fun to just play around with, even if you're not a plant
you're not
breeder.
Not growing yeah. cassava when you're back here in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I think that's a great project.
Did you know that this month is Sustainability Month and that Earth Day is being celebrated around the globe on April 22nd? Here's a list of events taking place this week, April 15th to April 22nd. On Monday, April 16th, Natalie Mahaud will be giving a talk titled How Long Can We Go? What is Needed to Achieve Low Temperature Climate Targets? The talk will take place in Wiley Robb Hall from 2:55 p.m. to 4 p.m. This lecture is part of Cornell's Climate Change Seminar Series. For more information, please visit the events page on Cornell's website. On Thursday, April 19th, Richard Durst will be giving a talk titled Pathological Science and the Perils of Thinking Outside of the Box from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. in Boyce Thompson Institute. This presentation will look at the various causes of what is commonly referred to as voodoo science. On Friday, April 20th, Cornell will be hosting SpringFest, a celebration of environmental programs, clubs, and collaborations across campus. The event is taking place at Hope Plaza from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. There will also be free food and music at the event. Also on Friday, April 20th, if you are willing to brave the cold, the Cornell Astronomical Society will be hosting public open house night at the Ferretti's Observatory on Cornell campus. Viewing starts at 8 p.m. and continues until midnight. Even on cloudy nights, the center is open and there are many opportunities to explore the indoor exhibits and learn about your favorite astronomical objects. This event repeats every Friday. On Saturday, April 21st at noon, join the Cayuga Nature Center for Animal Encounters Feeding Series Workshop, where the public can explore a specific group of animals with guidance and feedback from the animal care staff. This event repeats every Saturday. On Sunday, April 22nd, the space at Green Star will be hosting Earth Day Ithaca. The local theme this year is Art and Sustainability, taking place from 12 to 3 p.m., followed by performances from 3 to 5 p.m. Also, on April 22nd, the Cayuga Trails Club will sponsor the 29th Annual Earth Day Hike, a 4.4-mile-long section of the Cayuga Trail in the beautiful Monkey Run natural area of Cornell Botanical Gardens. Meet at the Cornell Community Garden Plots off Freeze Road at 1 p.m.
And that's all for the April 15th, 2018 edition of Locally Sourced Science. Esther Rakusin presented our local science news. Patricia Waldron conducted our interview. Liz Mahood covered science in the field. And Fayez Bakalian provided the science events calendar. Music today by Joe Lewis, Cece Giannotti, Blue Dot Sessions, Jonas Heimbecker, and bensound.com. Our show was produced at WRFI Community Radio, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.